Jane Latour and Ann Jochum's interviewing Marty Pottinger at New on September 27th, 1994. Marty, you're a carpenter, right?
Yes.
Yes. How long have you been a carpenter?
I started in construction in 1972, actually as a mason's apprentice in the Plasterers, Lathers, and Masons Union in Tampa, Florida. And I worked there for almost a year. And I actually started out as a laborer, and then I got to be a mason's apprentice. And then I walked off the job and started being a carpenter down in Florida. Again, worked as a carpenter in 1974 and moved up to New York in 1975. So ever since then, so it's been over 22 years I've been in construction, and about 20 of them have been as a carpenter.
So how did you get trained to be a carpenter? How did you learn how to be a carpenter?
I started out being a carpenter's apprentice in Florida, and so I had just on-the-job training. It was a non-union job. It was during the oil crisis, mm-hmm. and OPEC and everything, so mm-hmm. we were driving like 2 hours every day to work just to get a job. And so Big Al was just showing me what to do as mm-hmm. as an apprentice. And mm-hmm. And then when I moved up here, I worked for someone, a person at a very small company, and a lot of times it was just him and me, and he trained me. And I just would keep my eyes open, and spend my lunch hours going around, seeing what everybody else was doing. And had no formal training, and really ended up having to teach most everything to myself.
So,
that'll be good on the tape.
Lovely.
Yeah.
sound effects.
Yeah.
Were there other women on the job in Florida?
No, there weren't. Except one day. And this is 1972, so there were this was fairly radical. In 1970, one day, right before I left, I think about a month before I left, they said that there was another girl. People started telling me there was another girl who was over on a roof somewhere working, and I would keep looking for her. It wasn't that big a site, so it was kind of interesting. We were building condominiums that I didn't end up tracking her down, but people who work on those jobs know you hardly ever get a minute to yourself. But I would just remember if I ever was working high, because I was laying block by then, like I would be looking around trying to like see her with this idea that there was some other girl mm-hmm. over there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what she was doing, if she was a carpenter or I knew she wasn't a mason, I would have mm-hmm. known her. So, and I was very scared to meet her too, because I felt that my position was very tenuous. The first 2 months, the men didn't talk to me. Mm-hmm. So I felt my position had actually become more secure, but still I was like terrified that some other woman would come and like mess mm-hmm. things up. Yeah. I think when I know a lot of other women who felt similarly, that you just feel like you're the only one and you're walking such a thin line. It's so scary to think somebody else is going to come and like do things you wouldn't do mm-hmm. or,
Yeah.
So it was interesting. It wasn't a sense, it was a sense of excitement and terror. Mm-hmm. So when did I first start seeing other women on the jobs? Really, not until United Tradeswomen, and then we weren't working together on the construction jobs. We were working together to get women construction mm-hmm. jobs.
So, how would you describe what you do at New, non-traditional employment for women?
I teach 4 classes of 20 women a year, and I teach them shop. And tools, and we build a wall, and we build a toolbox, and I teach them safety and material identification. These are poor and unemployed women, so most of them have no non-traditional experience whatsoever, and most of them have never used a hammer. And I teach them blueprint reading, and I teach them counseling, peer counseling, so that we actually get to build skills to survive on the job and make our lives go the way we want.
So, in terms of strategies for survival on the job, self-preservation, what kinds of things do you teach them? How do you go about doing that?
Well, I tell them that they have to want more than the money, that if they just want the money, that it probably won't get them through the hard times, that we've all learned how to live on very little, so you have to want more than just the money. And I mostly feel like a sense of humor and a sense of the big picture is what gets you through. And one of the little things I have is, you know, he's an asshole, but he's my asshole.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way that sometimes when the guys do act like assholes, there is a sense of, you know, it's your guys, you know them. It's not so dissimilar than the people in your family. And there isn't really that big a difference that they happen to be, you know, you just happen to have who you had in your family and you just happen to have who you have on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of adopt a similar attitude about it, which is, you know, I mean, that's a gesture which doesn't read very well over tape, but
yeah.
It's best expressed by, you know, yeah, but they're my asshole,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And humor, and mm-hmm. just saying little jokes to yourself, little jokes to them, and not drawing a line. If you draw a line, they will cross it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about realizing that your sense of yourself and sense of self-respect actually isn't about drawing lines. I mean, you get to decide what you're going to do with and what you're not, and that's really important. But there's some way, I think, that some people get into, like, you know, don't do that, and of course then they do that. And you just got to laugh sometimes. One woman described to me, she may tell you the story, you may be interviewing her yourself, but on a union job down in one of the buildings in New York City, they painted every elevator door in like a 20-story building as a vagina.
Mm.
And so when the doors opened, it was a double opening door.
Yeah.
It was like a vagina opening. They had like labia. And
so
like,
what did she do with it?
She laughed. And commented about the artwork.
Mm.
Like I say, it's just wild sometimes, so
mm-hmm.
you just gotta, I mean, the stories I've heard of, I myself haven't, because I worked non-union, almost all the people who, I have stories from being in the union, you know, when I was in the union, but a lot of the people, they knew they were hiring me when they hired me, so, you gotta keep your sense of self-respect and set your limits. And be willing to lose your job if actually be clear with yourself that what it's all, you know, what it's worth to you.
Peer counseling, how does that work? What's the premise?
The premise is that that each of us are the smartest people to figure out our own situations, that we're the ones in the situations,
mm-hmm.
and our minds are the best places to go to decide what next, you know, what our
mm-hmm.
next step is, and that early hurts have just clogged up parts of our brain, and that actually having another person listen to you is actually the key, and that if someone just listens to you thoughtfully, that actually we're kind of built, that human beings are built to heal, not only from like scrapes and bruises, but from the emotional hurts that clog up our brain, and that actually if you just listen to somebody and learn how to listen well, and a few, you know, there's other techniques to in terms of listening well, that actually people undergo a very deep and profound but natural healing process, and kind of two heads are better than one, but that the other person isn't there to give you advice or figure out your problem for you or tell you what their similar situation was, but to actually lend their brain, their kind of human awareness to your
mm-hmm.
your thinking through your own problem. And so the women learn counseling with each other and learn how to sharpen their skills as listeners, and they also get experiences using their time as well, which is kind of the other part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it's going very well. Women have signed up for an 8-week course after they've graduated from here, which was voluntary, and it's going very well. And
the 8-week course is about what?
About learning peer counseling and actually doing
mm-hmm.
it. And they have sessions with each other outside of the class
mm-hmm.
Every week. And you get a chance to see other people close. Like there's a lot of isolation that people have to end up carrying around in the society, and you actually get a chance to shake that up a little. And it's very encouraging to people, you know. Like I say, it's very hard not to fall in love when you get to see anybody, like, for who they actually are with their struggles and, you know.
Right.
Excuse me, just check. Hello?
So tell us about your strategies for breaking down the barriers to learning new things. When we're interviewing tradeswomen, we keep hearing how important it is for the women to really master their craft, and you're teaching these new skills.
Yeah.
And how do you go about building up the confidence of the woman to really know that she can learn these new things?
Well, the first day I teach, or the second day, I actually have us make a list of every job anyone in the room has ever had. Mm-hmm. From babysitting, to mowing lawns, to newspaper routes, to shorter cooks, to hair cutting, to hairdressing. And then everybody gets to choose one of the occupations they've had, typesetting, you know, telephone marketing, and teach us one thing about it. You know, how much should they make an hour, what were their hours, and what's one thing to teach us about it. And so it becomes very clear that they are a tremendous resource of knowledge that they already know, that they didn't know, that they knew. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a whole process. Hey, sweetie. Yeah. That's okay, Lee.
I'm looking for how you might have shown.
Okay.
And so, I mean, they literally just say, I didn't know I knew that, you know. God, you know how to do word processing. Oh, it's nothing, word processing. It's so easy. No, it's not. You know, who mm-hmm. here thinks word processing is easy? Nobody raises their hand. You know what I mean? So then the word processor realizes she actually already has a skill. So that's one thing. I also think that the listening, the counseling, listening to each other for even like little 5 minutes each actually sets a tone. One of the interesting things about doing it is with these women that there's a lot of day-to-day struggle going on in their lives, and actually I haven't figured out how to achieve a balance where, as one woman put it, when we're here, we're trying to forget what's going on in our lives, not, you know, and we're trying to forget it and learn here, mm-hmm. learn what we need to know to get a job. You know, we're trying not to deal with that stuff. And I think that that's a fair comment, and I haven't quite figured out, you know, how you both bring people here so they actually can learn, and also deal with the fact that there's major life and death struggles going on in most of the women's lives on a regular basis. You know, homelessness, no tokens, emergency room hospital visits, you know, shootings, you know, just a lot, you know, mm-hmm. is going on. And I encourage the women to get to know each other. I don't know that this is what you want to know, but, you know, I learn their names in 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I learn 20 names. Mm-hmm. I do one go around, and I make myself know all their names by the end of it. And mm-hmm. my intent is to make it quite clear that I take them very seriously, and mm-hmm. that, you know, that they are people, and they get to have their feelings when I don't get their names right, you know, 5 times in a row. But yeah. I feel like that really sets a tone for what our relationship is going to look like. And speaking of the women I know, you know, I mean, I know many women who've been doing this for a long time, and some who've left and some who haven't. And I know very few women who have done this for 10 or 15 years who don't feel deeply inadequate about their skill level and deeply compromised. Even the women, I mean, I didn't even get formal training, right? So I should feel like totally my shit. But, you know, these women got to go to union schools, they got to go through a union apprenticeship program, but the level of oppression and the level of what we're reaching to do and going into this field is so tremendous that it's like the way I used to describe it on a job. I remember Big Al, you know, would say, you know, let the hammer do the work. Let the hammer do the work, Marge. Let the hammer do the work, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't. It was like he was a wave in my ear, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just couldn't. I was so scared, and I was having to push so far to be there, to imagine I should be there. Mm-hmm. I was having to focus so closely on whatever I was doing that literally, and I don't think everyone struggled quite as much as I did, but I couldn't understand what he was saying, you know. And I just had this image of, like, they would come by, and the men would come by and, like, bang my arm in a different way. It was just like water under the bridge, you know, because mm-hmm. it was like white noise. It was like trying to learn with a radio turned on in your head full blast. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that is a fairly accurate description of what most of us felt like. Mm-hmm. And so now, one woman I know has been a running a major city heating and air conditioning installation in one of the major plants in New York City, and is leaving to become a nurse's aide. She must earn $60,000 a year at least, and she's like going to be supposedly so happy earning $22,000 a year. And I say to her, why are you going to do this? And she's like, I tell you, don't tell anybody, and I'm not going to say who she is, but she's like, I just feel like I don't know what I'm doing, you know? She said, I just can't stand the pressure anymore. And this is after 15, 16, 17 years, and she's in charge of the thing at night, but she's you know, I mean, it's like, that to me was a perfect example of what a lot of us have gone against. And I did a show, you know, I do these performances.
Right.
I did a show out in Chicago about 5 years ago at the First National Women's Trade Women's Conference, and it was very interesting. I wanted to frame a rafter. We realized that we were going to build a house on stage during a Maria Callas operetta that lasted 15 minutes exactly, from Lucia the Lammermoor, and I don't know my opera very well, but I had found this piece and it worked for exactly what I wanted and everything. So this was going to play, and the women were going to literally frame, plumb, and wire a house on stage in 15 minutes, and that was going to be it.
Great.
And it was going to outlight. We had lighting and everything. It was great.
I saw it. It was great.
Oh, you did see it? Oh, did you really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, damn, I didn't know that. Yeah. So we had 80 cues in 15 minutes, 80 cues, and no director, no money. I mean, I was the director, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all volunteer help, right? All of us were just, and so I walked around, and it was a weekend conference, and tried to find women to work with me, number one, so they had to do a stage fright, but also they were going to publicly be doing things in front of other women. They were going to be nailing, they were going to be sawing, they were going to be doing things in front of other women, and that was asking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the more women who turned me down, the more that I was asking them to do, to literally just show up in front of other women and nail is not a little thing. I mean, to do it in front of men is not a little thing. What happened was, when it came time to frame a rafter, and I realized we had to ready make the rafters and just bring them in to really do it, you know, and tie those in together on stage, but have the rafters finished, I must have asked like 15 women who are carpenters, union carpenters, which I wasn't, right? And I never, you know, had never framed a rafter myself. We had ready-mades in Florida that we brought in on a crane. How do you frame a rafter? It was fascinating. The women would all turn to me with tremendous excitement and say, I don't know, but Barbara does.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara knows how. Barbara knows everything. From Cleveland, they'd say this. From Chicago, they'd say this. From Texas, they'd say this. From California. They're like, no, Susan knows. Susan knows. Go find Susan. Go find Susan. She's incredible. She's incredible. I go find Susan at this conference of 863 women, and Susan wouldn't know how to do it either. And then I go find Barbara, and Barbara wouldn't know. And what happened is, we ended up with Dale McCormick, who knew how to frame a rafter. So there was a lot of bitter, wonderful poetry and humor in this, like, saga as it unfolded. The Dale who wrote Against the Grain, you know her, right? She's a senator from Maine now, state senator from Maine. She wrote the first book of women called Against the Grain.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like our godmother, whether or not we knew of her, you know? I think I was probably even in construction before her, but, you know, she became our godmother, you know, by how she went about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale taught us that. But I thought it was fascinating that we all had our heroes, that all these women had somebody that they thought knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then that person, I mean, either was too shy to say it, you know, or whatever, too subconscious to say it. I think that happened some. But it was very interesting, very interesting. So to me, that's a very, you know, bittersweet example of how that all went.
Well, one of the things we wanted to ask you about was how you do your stories, how you choose your performance art. What are the stories that you think are the most significant to tell? And so maybe you could talk about some of the other ones that you've...
In my performances?
Yeah.
Well, in that show in Chicago, I thought just seeing each other build was pretty much said it all, you know? I couldn't think of anything more eloquent than watching us build. And the women made it into a comedy, which was very sweet and funny. I mean, it became, you know, and they did that once the performance was underway, so that was just like how it happened. And that was silent with the music, right? But they actually started singing to the music and, you know, they had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And then for myself, I just wanted to talk about what it felt like to me, the fact that I probably was going to live and die a carpenter, and that you get, as a female carpenter, you get a lot of respect from maybe your peers in some cases, or my peers, that I was one of the first and a woman and all that. But then also in terms of class, you're actually a carpenter, and you know, and that's that. Mm-hmm. And so when I first decided to do construction stories, I was actually struggling. I think I was 38 then, and I was struggling with the fact that I'd been a carpenter since I was in my early 20s, you know, like 21 or 22, and that I probably would be a carpenter the rest of my life, and that I was spending what seemed to me very precious lifetime, like building people's, you know, a garage door for people, or mm-hmm. building a dresser. I got to do a lot of different things, you know, redoing a bathroom, which at some point is like, yeah, that's great and everything, but, you know, it is just a bathroom. You know, and a lot of the people in New York City are going to move on and I charge $20,000 and they add $40,000 to their sale price because of what I got paid $20,000 to do. You know what I mean? So there's just a lot of issues in there. And the stories I ended up telling were, I think the stories that always interest me is, what's the mess we're in, and what are times that we glimpse out of it, you know? And so I did Killer Brook Memorial Wall, which was about like 6 one-minute stories as I built a brick wall on stage, about 6 people I know have died in construction. And that's very powerful, and it's at the end of the show, but it's not without showing people for who they are, that Jack Jensen, who ended up being the one man who showed me, who broke the silent code on me, you know, who broke the silence, knew he was going to be dead in 9 more months of white lung disease from cutting block for his whole career as a mason. He'd actually made foreman and had been a foreman for years, and he died when he was 49. And that Jack knew he was going to die, and that he was the one man on the job who, after 2 months, mind you, you know, figured out to talk to me and show me how to use a fucking trowel, you know. So that just says a lot, you know, about who can figure out what. And about racism, I think those are all the things that just profoundly confound us as humans, where we have yet to be able to talk about it that easily, to even kind of have a very personal discourse. I don't know that the political discourse is that useful. It's certainly useful to address inequities, but I don't know that we don't agree that it's bad, you know, or something, you know. It's like, so what's hard, it seems, is the personal stuff. So Johnson was a story about a mason tender who, at that point, was 72 years old, who lifted 60 tons of block and mud every day on the job. And everyone called him Johnson, and the end of that story is loading 60 tons a day, hoist and stack, the blocks hollow thunk as they hit together. Johnson, a part of the job, mason tender for 50 years. Big fella, no smiles, no chatter, no attitude, just Johnson, grandfather to someone. Firstly on the job, only man on the job with a last name, only dark man I ever saw doing construction in Florida. First day on the job, I asked him his first name. 3 or 4 condominiums later, he passed by me, stopped, and said, "Mister." You know, so that's that story. Yeah. And it really kind of shows, here's this black man who's 72 years old, the only black guy on the job in Florida. You know, what is that about, you know? Mm-hmm. Working as the mason tender, you know, loading up for him. I ask him his name, the only guy with the last name, right, and ask him his name, and after a while he waits like, you know, 3 months to answer me, and then says, "Mister." Yeah, it is. So those are the stories that kind of excite me. There's a woman in Madison, Wisconsin, the first woman I knew who died as a carpenter. She was partners with another woman, and she fell off the roof at the end of the day. So I, as a female, have a very, I mean, I just brought the pride I have, and I think that story is like the sun's final pink gleam on the plywood seams. You know, the sun's going down, and there's this beautiful plywood roof laid out in front of you, and the pink shining, the pink and plywood, you know, it looks real pretty together. There's a lot of pink in plywood. Mm-hmm. And the sun's final pink gleams on the plywood seams, so straight, so square, so snug. And that's the end of that story, but it was like, had she just like brought up the last roll of paper, the last bundle of shingles? Because, you know, just the sense of her, you know, and then how you just like lose your balance, you know. And there's a humor. I think all the stories have a humor. I mean, you can see that in Johnson. But, and I call her Woman Who Fell From the Roof. Never knew her name, Woman Who Fell From the Roof. Carpenters, contractors, partners with another woman. Woman Who Didn't Fall From the Roof. You know, and that's the like little joke, but it's like, ooh, God. And then I talk a lot about how much I love construction, actually. I talk a lot about in the show. I have a whole section because I love the sounds of construction. You know, the screw gun, you know. And I talk about I love the people in construction. So I do these little, like, 8 seconds vignettes of people that, you know, just kind of talk about class. And we don't get to talk about on the job, you don't, you know, and few people do talk about how much we love what we do, and I think that really, at least that's one of the real precious things about doing something like carpentry, is that you actually do care about it, and that people do, you do go back and say, I built that, you know, and so many people work jobs that, you know, that actually isn't a part of what they're able to do at this point, so that's something I very much think that story to get told. And then that show in Chicago gave me the idea to do construction stories. I think in the end I ended up building things. So some of the things I built in construction stories I just built. And I told stories about jobs that went wrong, you know. But like just life stories, like the fact that, you know, maybe plaster debris from washing our tools clogged up the drain. You know, and like it's like all of a sudden the audience is like, oh my God, you know. Because it's like, oh God, and about this huge flood on a job I did 2 weeks after I left it, you know. But just talk about that mistakes, I like to make it clear mistakes are part of living. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to be ashamed about mistakes, that's a part of doing something. And carpentry taught me that, you know, society's really silly about mistakes, you know, but mistakes are what you do on your way to getting somewhere.
Have you written down these stories?
Oh yeah, they're all written down. Yeah, I've been doing the show, I did it in England, I did it in California a couple times. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
great.
Videotape, so, yeah, it's a nice show, very human show.
Do you find that you bring your performance art and your experience as an artist to your teaching?
And I talk about it some, yeah.
It sounds like, you know, that you are really able to bring the you know, bring together a lot of things into the classroom so that you can really transmit a lot of things that you've thought about and experienced to the young women that you're teaching. And do you find, how satisfying do you find that role?
Well, I find that I can speak with much more pride since I did construction stories about being a carpenter. You know, I that's the nice thing about making art is you can get clearer for making it. You know, it is a real chance to grow. It's like one way you can grow. And so I can, I'm just much more proud of it than I was. And in a funny way, I kind of, at least at this point, I'm still doing some jobs, but I decided to leave it as my main profession, and that brought a lot of grief, and I had to cry a lot of hours about not remaining a carpenter. It's a very important part of who I am to myself. And I used to have a job as a school bus driver before I was a carpenter, and during this gas, you know, right at the beginning of this oil thing in 73, and I rode up to a gas station pump once, and everybody has to wait in line, but school buses don't.
Oh, yeah.
So I drove up to the pump with the kids in the bus and everything, and I said, I'm a school bus, to the gas station attendant. He goes, no, you're not. I thought, well, that's actually true, isn't it? No, I'm not a school bus. I drive a school bus. But there was something about where being a carpenter ended up, you know, like, it was who I am, and so it was a big thing to actually decide to come here and teach, and it was a big thing to decide to put the level of time that I put into being a carpenter into being a artist, you know, and part of that is class stuff, and it made a big difference when I found out there was all these people in the art world that actually were working class people that I didn't really know yet. Mm-hmm. That was nice.
just to see.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I guess we're all everywhere.
Yeah. So, and you, what do you see as the main things that you can see about the women coming in that are sort of indicators or predictors of success
mm-hmm.
on the job?
That's
what
good.
Kinds of?
I think a sense of humor, a sense of support. I ask them, I interrogate women basically about their support systems. And I've learned from Mel as well how she does it. She does it like this and goes for work experience, work ethic, and good relationships at work, you know, why they leave the last job and what systems are set up. And I don't think it makes sense for you to go into a field where you're going to be working with men unless you can tell you like them.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to like them in any particular way. You just got to not dislike them,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
They don't have to be your lovers or your boyfriends or your husbands or anything else, but you actually do have to. I mean, why? Why would you do that? You know, I mean, we all have struggles, but don't do that, you know? So that's one thing, actually. If I have a strong sense that, you know, that women, you know, find men as interesting as I do, even though they're goofballs, you know,
mm-hmm.
half the time, you know? And so then, like I said, the thing about wanting to do it, that they can envision that there's some reason why they want to do it. I ask them if they're growing up, do they, you know, do they like to fix things? Do they have any experience, you know? The fact that they've gone up to a woman working construction in the street and asked her, like, how did she get her job, is a big indicator to me that she's willing to break a few barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Does she have a sense of herself, actually? I mean, does she have a sense of herself, which is, that's pretty amorphous, but yet you can, you know. What else in her life has she done? What else, I ask him, what have you done in your life that you really wanted, that you really had to work for? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Some I try to get mad to see how mad they get, you know.
Yeah.
See if they get too, you know, cranky, you know, just that's not bad, you know. And this is the only thing about this program that's particular, is that if women are trying to fulfill some public assistance requirement to be in the training program,
mm-hmm.
you know, that
yeah.
we would fit that bill, and yet what are they doing here? I mean, there's a lot of public, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of training programs. Why here? I mean, already that kind of says something, but we actually don't take, you know, over 65, you know, 70% of
mm-hmm.
the women who apply, you know.
Yeah.
And they may all be great, but it's a lot, you know. This training program is a lot. I tell them, you know those drawers at home where you got all that string and rubber bands and batteries and all that sitting in that drawer, you know, scissors and everything?
Yeah.
I said, being in school for 10 weeks dumps out like a third of that drawer. I said, and then being on the job will dump out the rest of the drawer. So this is no little joke, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You need three layers of support systems, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You need the system when your mom, you know, and you just had the argument and your sister's kid has the measles, then who's going to take care of your
mm-hmm.
children, you know, or then what are you going to do to see you're leaving your home at 6 a.m.?
So you get them to think about it before the fact.
Oh, yeah,
and
I tell them,
build
I
it into
them
their
to, we let them in,
yeah.
I expect them to have worked at least 3 months
mm-hmm.
on a job, but that's, I'm not interested if they graduate, I'm not interested if they get a job, I'm only interested if they have worked 3 months on the job that they've gotten, and if that's the agreement, I said, I'll work my butt off for you, but you better. You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm getting clearer and clearer about it because, you know, I want them to know that's the agreement, not that you graduate this course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, at some point, like, that's very sweet, but that's not why we're getting paid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to, you know, fulfill contract requirements and all that, so I feel more, I have a better understanding of the situation now than I did when I got here, so I'm quite, you know, kind of tough about it.
You worked with other people like Irene Soloway
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I'm setting up United Tradeswomen.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the most profound things that you learned about organizing through United Tradeswomen? What are some of your observations
well,
about that?
I think for almost any of us, and I think it app explains why I'm here now, you know, there were a lot of things I could do, a lot of places I could go, I'm sure. And that is that that working class women are the smartest women, actively smart. You know, I'm sure everybody's very smart, but in terms of active brains, you know, that I'd ever met. And we just did the work and we got things done. And it was really fun. And we really had a good time doing it. And some of us were still in touch with each other. That's a little unusual. There were some big, you know, disagreements and controversies and everything. And there's just a way we... It was like a group of women who got theirs and were very clear that getting theirs wasn't all they were interested in getting. Mm-hmm. They were interested in other women getting theirs, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that's like, that's. I think every human being feels like that at some point, but I think some of us have lost track of it. And so to be that clear about it, that it was like, yeah, I got mine, but now let's get everybody's, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's go get everybody's. Yeah. And some of us have AIDS now, some of us have left the field, some of us, you know, have moved, you know, but people kind of know where everybody's at, you know, we kind of, just was a sense of, and it's not, it was similar to, I was involved in the women's movement in Florida, and I considered that a very great experience because it was St. Petersburg, Florida, which is kind of, you know, for some people stereotype is like, you know, well, it's like, what's that, you know? But we had a brilliant and vibrant women's movement, you know, and it was so great to learn about the women's movement down there because it really helped me from getting confused about both the scale of the women's movement and what it really was, that it was not middle class, just the middle class white women, you know, and that that isn't all we were doing, was getting like cushy jobs, you know, or at all. I mean, in Florida, we were working, you know, saving women's lives. I really felt grateful for that. And United Trades Women was similar. There was a sense of tremendous possibility and tremendous purpose. And that pulls everybody along. I mean, that always does. One of my favorite stories about solidarity in Russia, Russia and Poland, was about the third or fourth big strike at Gdansk in the shipyards. The vodka sales in Poland dropped 90%. During the strike. The strike lasted a very long period of time, and I realized that these people understood that they actually can't drink that heavily mm-hmm. and think as clearly as they need to think to be successful. Mm-hmm. So it's clear to me that everybody's right there, mm-hmm. you know? As foggy as people look, as, you know what I mean, as hopeless as it looks, actually, when people have a sense of where we're all going, mm-hmm. People pull out of their shit, you know, and then you got to deal with it sometimes. It's not like it's just going to drop away, which is where, to me, counseling comes in, you know. But it was very exciting, and I felt like UT was kind of a different kind of example of that, where it was just so... We were breaking into the unions, you know, women were trying to form women's committees. I mean, you know some of this, mm-hmm. you know, women... Unions were banning, you know. I mean, men hadn't all figured out to be allies. I mean, the women now that I'm teaching go on the jobs, and at least 40% of the men are open allies. I mean, that
big
was
change.
Not the case.
Yeah.
That was not the case. And 80% of the men are neutral to ally, in the neutral to ally period, mm-hmm. you know. Mm. I mean, that's really different. And our numbers are not, you know, there's been a lot of revolving, you know, we've lost a lot of things. We haven't at all achieved the numbers that we should be achieving. But, you know, still, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. So, and that doesn't, you know.
Do you see changes in the women coming in? There's recently been all these books, actually one I'm thinking of in particular, about females' loss of self-confidence in the post-pubescent period.
Yeah.
And that kind of, I mean, it seems sort of a universal kind of truth that women are still, females are still dealing with. And do you observe any?
Well, our women, I mean, down there, the women you just saw, I mean, Terry's 19, you know, Louise is 24, Marilyn's 44, and Dana's
don't know how old Dana is. She wasn't one of my students. She's about 26, probably 27. So we have a pretty significant age range. So I don't know about the pre-pubescent time, but
I just meant in terms of a carryover from that kind of.
When you asked that question, what I thought of was that I think because we offer the women the bigger picture here, they have the bigger picture, mm-hmm. and for a while knew, for I don't know how many years, for a while, one of its periods was as a jobs bank more, like women came and they didn't have any school, they just kind of got channeled towards jobs or told where they could go to try to get them, you know? And now our women are meeting those women, and those women are like thrilled but heartbroken to hear that the women are getting this quality of an experience mm-hmm. before they went out. And I mean, women are definitely forming lifetime friendships in the 9 weeks they're in mm-hmm. class here, there's no doubt about it. All of them say that they've never, I mean, these are school dropouts, these are like true, they fight for the title truant of the, you know,
yeah.
truant of the year. And they love it, and they love math, and they love physical fitness, and they love shop, you know, I mean, so I don't think the lack of self-confidence, I mean, they leave here with a sense of responsibility, mm-hmm. and they know that if they fuck up, but also these kind of women know that anyway, I mean, there is a real sense in the culture that, you know, you screw up for your, you know, you're not just screwing mm-hmm. up on your own, you know, you're mm-hmm. messing up for other people, but, so, and they definitely leave with a sense of pride, and you know, they're as afraid as the other women I was describing, but I think a little less so since we went 20 years ago, you know, before, and now mm-hmm. we can come back and tell them the stories. And Irene came and gave a talk at the last guest speaker's night with some other women who just graduated and had jobs now. And it's very, very powerful and very sweet to just realize that she and I and, you know, in our various different paths, but can come back, and it's very different having somebody say, I just did this for 20 years, you mm-hmm. know, and that you look and look at the person and say, well, that they're not too much of a nut, you know?
Yeah. Right.
You know, I mean, that's very different. You know, we really didn't have, you know, anybody, and, you know, mm-hmm. there seemed to be a period where women, well, I just heard a lot of stories in New York and the unions, that the initial women who came in, in part, were a lot from raised middle-class backgrounds, which makes sense.
And
I mean,
strong feminist ideology.
Right.
Sort of.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was definitely raised middle class and didn't have a strong feminist ideology because, I don't know, the women's movement in 1972, you know, I had heard that they had burned bras in Atlantic City. Like, that's all I knew about it, you know? And I don't even know if I knew the word feminist. And I didn't know what to think about it. I didn't really think about that much. I was mm-hmm. pretty much dealing with day-to-day struggles. But I knew I wanted to build. And also the backlash hadn't happened yet in 72. They just didn't know what to make of me, but there was no sense that the construction industry was going to soon be under, you know, mm-hmm. an attack. When did you start? Do you remember what year it was?
Well, I started non-union too, and it was a progression. Like, I was a sanitation worker,
yeah.
and I worked in a gas station, and
uh-huh.
was a laborer, and then got into a CETA program.
Yeah.
In the mid-70s.
Yeah.
78 or
yeah.
something.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. just, there wasn't an organized backlash against me. They just were like, you know, we're not talking to her,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But then it got organized in the construction industries against women being mm-hmm. in. And so right. that's when most of the women I know got in, was after the lawsuits. I mean, several of my closest friends ended up being the first or second women in the unions, and I think that it was the confidence. I mean, I have to say, it must have been that they knew me as a carpenter, even though I wasn't union. I mean, it had to be, it just can't be an accident, that, you know what I mean? That my closest friends who were like Burger King people ended up being the first, you know, women's mason.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I didn't go say, hey, do you want to, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not my role at all, was to encourage them. But I think they looked around and thought, well, I guess I can't do or something,
yeah.
which is what the men do. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
right.
when they see a woman. I mean, when you see a woman doing something, everybody thinks they could do it, you know. Mm. Well, if she can do it. But I used to drive taxi and, you know, I mean, school bus and all these other kind of non-trad jobs.
Yeah.
And I think, I guess that's, you know.
What about the women's movement in terms of allies? Do you see anything happening in New York City outside of new that support for women in non-traditional jobs? And there's still a lot of outstanding struggles going on. do you see the women's movement, so to speak, playing a role? Or where are the allies for women in non-traditional jobs?
Well, I was talking about the women, our backgrounds, the first women, and that's right, that's where I was with that whole little thing. Mm-hmm. It was about, the, like, you know, raised middle class, and there's this kind of... I think recently, I mean, you probably know about the hearings down at the Human Rights Commission, and I kind of have an angle on that story, being that I know the people at the Human Rights Commission who ended up, one was my lover for 17 years, and they just happened to be there, and she happened to get a CETA job, you know, 15 years ago with a woman who then was doing this down there. So it's like, it's just interesting to think of the effects of all of us, you know, so I think that helped that whole thing come to be, is what mm-hmm. I guess I'm mm-hmm. trying to say, you know,
mm-hmm.
that she happened to have been lovers with a carpenter for 17 mm-hmm. years, you know, and that it's like we're all out there. It's not formal. I'm not aware, although we send, a woman just called me who was brutally harassed on her job as at Pottery Barn, sexually mm-hmm. harassed, and she wants to be a student here, and I sent her to Now Legal Defense Fund, so... Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a, you know, an AUD. I mean, yeah. I assume that, you know, that's a strong women's movement ties, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's like we're out there, and those hearings really, I think, came to be because women who had been, in, you know, active in the women's movement when it looked the way it used to look, you know,
mm-hmm.
now are working these jobs and have a sense of things, and then the women who were still organizing women in construction, you know, could demand it. Although I do think the critical issue is the training of leadership,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's the critical issue for any political movement, for the women's movement, for the lesbian gay movement, mm-hmm. for anything, and I think that's one of the things I'm actually working on in my counseling, by teaching counseling here.
So how are you dealing with it?
Well, I think to train leadership, you actually help people get into shape so they can think for themselves, so they can think, period. Then they can think for themselves, which is kind of the same thing, but you know what I mean? And that once you've got somebody who can think, then they naturally will start thinking about themselves and then another person, and then they will start thinking about three or four people, and that the way I envision the classes going, they in and of themselves allow people to take on leadership and try stuff out in the actual teaching of the counseling
mm-hmm.
and in the running of the support groups that will train them. I mean, to me, a leader is someone who can think about people well and who also can make it clear that those people need to think about them well and that they won't brook no attacks and, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that we are all in this together. And so, to me, that's the big key. And so, my plan is that this actually will allow people a chance to try that out, and that then you can take that and apply it anywhere, you know, that you actually don't need much more than be able to figure out what emotional struggles stand in your way of trusting other people, of yourself being trustworthy, you know, of being able to listen to other people and offer a vision and make it clear that we're all peers. And that you're actually not trying to, you know,
mm-hmm.
trying to do an odd thing, you know, hide your own problems or struggles or, you know, build some odd little place for yourself on other people's backs. And that to me is what's unstoppable. I mean, that to me is what, if people can think, and that people are supposed to be able, and that you expect everyone else there to do the same. You actually expect those people to be able to think for themselves
mm-hmm.
and take on leadership.
Right. You're not just solving all the problems yourself, but you're...
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you're planting seeds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just starting those early relationships with people to see, you know, who would like to, you know, check this out and stuff. And to me, that's leadership training, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a real nice, very grassroots way. And it has everything to do with relationships. I mean, to me, it has everything to do with relationships. And that's where we're the most vulnerable, when we actually don't have the relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes a lot of time, and that's...
So you talk about it as a process and as something that takes a lot of patience, that you cultivate that in terms of the way that women think about themselves on the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's not so dissimilar than being a parent in the kind of wonderful opportunity being a parent gives you, despite all the oppression and the struggles and everything. It actually allows you to think about somebody, you know. Mm-hmm. And the more you can remember that they can think too, and then list, you know, their participation, the better it goes. But where that looks unequal is not a useful metaphor in terms of what I'm thinking of, you know, but that's just stuff that I think where that looks unequal. But anyway, I had some thought in there, but I didn't end up remembering about being a parent or something. But yeah, it's a pleasure. I guess that's what I mean, that you get so much, that was it, that
it's
you get so much
difficult,
from being a parent,
but, yeah.
And you get so much, right, mm-hmm. from building those yeah. relationships with people. You get so much back mm-hmm. that it's worth all the time you actually end up putting into doing it. But it's very anti-status quo to build close relationships mm-hmm. with people, right? I mean, it really is very anti-capitalism, anti-everything, you know, mm-hmm. to actually say, if you go down, I go down, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, that's, you know, that like the mm-hmm. ooh, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of anti, the unions haven't all been sort of forthcoming in terms of women. I mean, they're sort of under the gun. But what mm-hmm. what do you see happening here at New in terms of making that a world that's not so foreign for the women and making them feel part of that they, I mean, what happens to get them to deal with the idea of union and see themselves as belonging?
Well, they learn union history, and that's very mm-hmm. exciting. The electricians actually get to learn this union history at Labor College. I don't know how they still mm-hmm. do it, but at United Tradeswomen, we went to a couple of classes, and it was really fun. You know, it really was fun. It's fun to know what the hell happened, you know, mm-hmm. for real and not the mm-hmm. bullshit way. So that's thrilling, and we teach that. You know the book, The People's History of the United States?
Howard Zinn?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love if we could make that a graduation gift, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
Here, just because I feel like that just was like, I knew it, you fucking bastards. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it, you know, and I kind of didn't know it, you know, because
yeah.
you don't, you
right,
know.
You don't.
But I felt like I did, you know,
right.
I felt like.
Or when you heard it, you connected so
yes,
much,
yes,
like intuitively.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that right away, you know, lies with you, and I don't really, I haven't figured out, like, you know, any final way to talk about the corruption and everything mm. in a way that doesn't actually just add to
discourage,
the cynicism.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I talk about it, and it's like everybody's kind of given up about that, about what the possibilities are, and I understand that. And so it's hard to, I just feel it needs to be mentioned that yes, they're corrupt, and yes, they're, you know, they're not for us, and yes, they've done all this stuff very much against their will, but these women know, and I know, it's so much in their interest, and it's just like being, you know, it's just like it is in our lives anyway. I don't know that it's so different, mm-hmm. but, you know, they just can't tell how much they need you, you know?
Right.
And
that's
if
absolutely
you can stay
true.
Clear, I mean, the women will come back and say, you know, it's like the men say, it's so different since I've been here, you know, and, you know, they talk about interesting things, and, you know, it's really true. So I talk about that, and they talk about it, and there was something you were asking about unions and everything. There was something I thought that I thought about it. I talk a little bit about the TDU movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't know very much about it, but I just talk about that people are out there just like they are everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and they're in about the same numbers they are everywhere. You know, that we're not the majority, but that most of the people are actually scared to move to the right or to the left, you know? And yeah, I think they leave here with a sense that they are connected to, they definitely with a sense they're connected to a historical movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes a long way. But it's hard. I mean, you know, I call the women. I keep in much more contact than probably anyone ever has here.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel real grateful that the job lets me do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually call and talk to them, and a lot of times they just cry, you know.
Yeah.
The second they hear my voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids are this, and the aunts mm-hmm. move back to Puerto Rico, and, you know, it's just like a lot is going on. And it's just hard for me to envision that they're getting up at 4 in the morning, they're taking the kids somewhere by 5,
5:30 or 5 a.m.
Right.
They leave for the job at 6. They're at the job. They work this incredible job, you know, and they love it. They say they love it, and they do. I mean, it really is nice work, you know. It could be so much better.
Yeah.
And then they come home, and then they're mothers again, you know. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to say, and I don't know, Anne, what do you think about all this, but a lot of the women are leaving the field,
mm-hmm.
and I mentioned that stuff about they're leaving feeling like they never quite mastered it, mm-hmm. and they never feel like they never really, you know, were in charge or got over that. And that's all counseling stuff, see, to me.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is, counseling is a big role to play here. You know,
right.
I mean, effective
yeah.
counseling does,
mm-hmm.
because that's just feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
right.
feelings that are holding them back. That's nothing to do with reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty big thing to notice.
Right. I mean, I think that's common for women.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
women historians
right.
feel that, academics
right.
feel it,
right.
women feel it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Right.
Right. And so
yeah.
to me, that's like when I start questioning, you know, the women are desperate for hard information, and at times they rebel very powerfully and strongly and vocally against the counseling. Not all of them, but, you know, some
mm-hmm.
do. And so I still have a lot, you know, there's a lot I need to, like, just kind of figure out how to articulate something there. But it's like, you're not going to lose your job because you don't know how to use a screwdriver. You know, you're going to lose your job because you started drinking again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you're going to lose your job because you couldn't figure out, you know, how to deal with childcare,
mm-hmm.
and understandably, but that's why you're going to lose your job,
mm-hmm.
you know. Like, let's be real. You know,
yeah.
you don't have to read a blueprint to keep your job at this point, you know. But they want, and it's also, who doesn't want knowledge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How
right.
thrilling isn't it? You know, they're
yeah.
like ecstatic. They're like, hell with counseling, give us a blueprint reading, you know.
Right.
We need more blueprint reading, you know. And I understand that, you
yeah.
know. And also,
uh-huh.
it's like, it's that yucky-ducky feelings of feeling those old feelings. And it does feel
mm-hmm.
yucky-ducky, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that is why we don't feel them, you know. Because they do. I mean, humiliation feels incredibly humiliating, you know. Like, that's the one thing about it, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of say, yeah, that's true. That's true. I can understand that. But, and there was one thing about, oh, so the women are discouraged. So, do you have a thought about the unions and everything?
No, I just wondered, you know, if there was a conscious effort to make them feel that in the world where it is basically run by men, another world that's supposed to be friendly to the member, but
mm-hmm.
is so often hostile,
mm-hmm.
what was happening to make them feel like they belong. And I think that historical approach and making them feel
mm-hmm.
part of a movement is the
mm-hmm.
most positive thing that
mm-hmm.
that can inspire people
mm-hmm.
and make them want to go forward rather than just feeling falling
mm-hmm.
away and discouraged.
And, yeah, and their families are sometimes proud of them, and their families are sometimes very opposed
yeah,
to what
they're doing. Yeah, that's a sad thing that I see in doing these interviews and having been talking to women doing these non-traditional jobs since 1990,
yeah.
is that I always think, God, your mother must be so proud of you.
Right.
And some are, and some aren't,
right.
or some say, yeah, she kind of is, or
yeah.
at times, or...
Yeah.
You know.
But like no one in my family is, you know, proud of me as a carpenter. I mean,
yeah.
never even thought about it until now. But, you know.
Yeah.
Same here, middle class, leap downward.
Yeah.
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 Well, it took
exactly.
a long time for my family to have any pride in the work that I do in terms of union.
Yeah.
Now they're all, you know, they all think it's thrilling. But before it was just sort of like this aberrant thing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, downward kind of.
Right.
Mobility.
You know.
Right.
How could you be interested in them?
Right,
you know,
and the women still struggle with that.
Yeah.
I have a copy of a speech I can give you that the woman did for her our graduation just now. It's a speech, 2 months ago. Well, I'll find it for you.
Okay.
But,
what was her theme?
I was moving my desk, that's why I explained this mess here.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense of discouragement, oh, that women are leaving the field and don't have a sense of having accomplished as much as they did. And I also notice women, it's very hard for women to encourage other women now to be in the field,
mm-hmm.
it looks like to me.
Because it looks so hard and they've experienced so much.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah so they don't want to feel right.
And so in the last many cycles, we've had no carpenters join. One carpenter joined the union, two carpenters. Now we had 6 carpenters join the union since I've been, you know,
mm-hmm.
Well, 8 since I started teaching, but just 6 this last cycle.
And one, I feel like, well, do I know what I'm doing? You know, I mean, I haven't been a union carpenter in New York City, you know, like, mm-hmm. so maybe I'm sending them in and I actually don't know what I'm, you know, sending them into. But I actually, and I met all these women at this festival in Northampton that were former carpenters, and they were so apologetic about having left the field. I went over to a picnic table and sat down. There was two black women talking, two white women talking, and I was by myself. So I sat down in the middle and started making jokes. And we talked for an hour and a half. I get up to go get, like, some more decaf or something. One of the women comes with me. We've been talking this entire time. At that point, she tells me this very powerful story about having been a counselor for these young kids, and somebody ended up getting shot, that she'd really pulled through a hard time, and it really looked like his future was bright, so she needed to talk about that, right? And then she mentions that she used to be a union carpenter. And my whole, when I sat down, I said I was a carpenter. You know what I mean? I mean, I was there to do construction stories or parts of it, you know? So it was just fascinating. We go back to the table, and I sit down, and these women are still talking, and I say, can you believe it? I said, this woman, all this talk about carpentry, this woman just told me she's a union carpenter. And one of the other women goes, oh yeah, I used to be a union carpenter too. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, get out of here. It's like, what is this? So weird. We've been talking for 2 hours about construction and everything, and two of you have been union carpenters and you don't mention it? Mm-hmm. And it's because they said, oh, they feel so bad that they left the field. And it's like, I mean...
Yeah, so it's really a hard thing of women having achieved so much and done so much and been there and put themselves through it, and yet not being able to feel, because there are so many negatives
right.
that they get. Yeah. It's like a crescendo.
Yeah.